Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, welcome to Film Fandango, the film podcast. My name's David Reed, this is Merrick Larwood.
Hello, film listeners.
Hello, film listeners. And this week we have a guest with us. It's Mr. Joel Morris. Hello, Joel.
Hello.
Joel is a comedy writer and all around... do you write serious things as well?
No, mainly comedy.
Mainly comedy. I saw a short film you made that was quite serious.
Yeah, that had no jokes in it. And everyone who knows what we normally write was waiting for there to be a joke at the end, and they said, it's just horrible.
What's it called?
It's called The Cunning Woman. And if you type that in, it'll turn up somewhere on there's a video that you can watch on.
Oh, is it on Vimeo?
Online. Yeah, it's hosted on Vimeo somewhere. So
all the good arty stuff is on Vimeo. Yeah.
Rather than YouTube.
Why is YouTube something you've done in your bedroom,
yeah,
and when you've got a proper crew in and it's lit properly,
Vimeo. Why is that though? I mean, is there any reason other than brand?
Filmmakers go on Vimeo, yeah, they respect it.
You can put a password on it.
Well, it's like the difference between going to Subway and Pret and going into a nice cafe. You know what you're going to get. YouTube's like a McDonald's, isn't it?
Yeah. So I can't put my cats falling off things on Vimeo. That would be frowned upon.
I wonder what would happen unless it was really well lit.
Not unless I put some Wagner under it.
Yeah, they didn't have the copyright thing.
Yeah, that's true. So. Well, we're going to talk about some movies. Joel's brought us in a film, but we'll talk about that in a little bit. I have seen a current release, a comedy film, right up our streets, called They Came Together. Now, have you guys heard about this?
I've seen it on buses or something.
Yeah.
I had it advertised to me, and I read a review of it. That was like a middling review, but the review made it sound like it would be brilliant. It's like a 3-star review, and I read that and went, well, that sounds like quite a good film.
What newspaper was the review?
It was in The Guardian, or maybe The Telegraph. It's a spoof romantic comedy, which made me want to punch someone, because that's a brilliant idea, and I've thought of that.
It's
and I'm annoyed someone's finally done it.
It's Amy Poehler and Paul Rudd doing the absolutely the absolutely typical, the archetypical rom-com plot, and Bill Hader is their friend who they're explaining how they got together, and then you go and you see the whole thing, and it is, as you say, it's a spoof in that they do all the tropes and then just rip the piss out of them completely, and it is really, really funny. It's really good. There is a basketball scene that I think is like a perfect sketch. You know that scene in all of these things where the man has gone to his traditional male sanctuary of the basketball court, and he's talking to his friends who are all, you know, different in different ways, whilst they're all telling him about, hey man, forget women, or just go, no, I regret splitting up with my girl, and just all of that, and it's so well done. It is brilliant. I haven't laughed out loud as often at a film for a long time than this one. It's properly good.
That's really good news, because you can get it to rent, I think. If you've got Sky,
Simultaneous release.
Yes, I think Sky have got it to pay for, and I imagine all the other brands have got it to pay for. So I thought, oh, that's a date night that won't be dumb.
Yeah.
Which are quite hard to find.
What's the tone of it like? Because a lot of these, what I get off of a lot of that sort of Seth Rogen, Paul Rudd comedies, is they're a bit, I always feel as if they're enjoying it more than the audience is.
Okay.
And do you know what I mean? I can't remember my finger, where they're all sort of, aren't we all really, really funny?
It is a bit of a nod and a wink, as in it's, and this is my only criticism of it, which, you know, they play the laugh absolutely, and at the expense of the reality they're creating. which I think they do on Talladega Nights, for instance, or films of that ilk. And the problem with that is, yes, the story is fluff. It's the absolutely typical rom-com story, so it doesn't matter. But if they don't believe a word of it and they're just going through the beats, the film then still drags because you're not invested in the story. And it doesn't matter if you've heard the story before. If they're not invested in it, there's no reason for you to. So even though the individual scenes are really
it's
fun...
It's all right, Dave.
Thanks. Went a bit squeaky there. I don't know why.
I thought you were getting emotional.
Yeah. Even though the individual scenes are really funny, it does overstay its welcome slightly just because it doesn't believe in the story that it's
telling. We had this thing. We've done three of these with Charlie Brooker. We've done the Touch of Cloth things, which are parodies of detective films. Yeah. And they've got the full plot of a detective thing. And
gag-heavy sort of Naked Airplane Gun Airplane style.
And
that was
we watched lots of Airplane and lots of these things, and we found out the amazing thing when you watch Airplane is that for the last 10 minutes of Airplane, there are almost no jokes. Mm-hmm. It's a proper thriller because actually they borrowed it from a proper thriller, and the last 10 minutes are the last 10 minutes of Zero Hour, the film they bought the script for. Because there comes a point in any of these things where you kind of need to care about the characters.
Yes.
And we found out that if we did jokes in Touch of Cloth, if we made the murders not real and we made it not a real detective story, the audience lost interest about 40 minutes in.
It's interesting.
It's an hour and a half long, and what you need to, at some point, you have to kick in and go, actually, that girl might get her throat cut.
Yeah.
Even though you're doing a load of stupid sight gags and stupid bum puns, it also needs to be a real film.
It's why I think Airplane is sort of like the perfect immortal comedy, is that for exactly that reason, its gag rate is incredibly high and they never miss a beat on it, but you care, and the protagonist could not be more earnest. Mm. And that works. And Life of Brian similarly is surreal and sort of comes off the rails more than Airplane does, but Brian never doesn't care about the plight he's in. It's always hell for him to go to.
Terry Jones pointed this out. They did an edit of Holy Grail, and whatever sketch they put at 50 minutes, no one laughed. Even if you put the best sketch, because at 50 minutes, people are tired of laughing and need to care. And you watch Parker and Stone, you watch the South Park and Team America movies, there's a proper story, and the people are really in trouble. And about 50 minutes, no matter how funny your film is, it has to also have a real story in it. And I think the Python's got that right.
Yeah.
There's usually a bit. I think Shaun of the Dead, they said that about it's about an hour and 10 in Shaun of the Dead. They took a load of jokes out because people weren't laughing, and actually, his mum's in danger.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had to play it straight for a minute, and then you could do some jokes at the end. But there's a bit, like a lull. It's almost like a movement in a symphony or something.
It's like dating someone. If they're really funny, first of all, I mean, that's great, you're really interesting. But, you know, after about 6 months or so, you just want to get to know the real person.
Yeah, because, well, you want to know they're taking this seriously, really.
You don't want to hear jokes every morning or someone to be funny.
It's like going out with Tony Blackburn. You want someone to stop. Yeah. Who's the real Tony Blackburn? Stop doing the DJ patter.
I wonder how close to the 50-minute mark the Phoebe Cates' My Dad Died at Christmas speech is in Gremlins.
It will be.
It'll be around there, won't it?
Yeah, what serious consequences.
I hate all that. I love it. I can imagine all the execs where they're sitting in some office with some graph.
No, quite the opposite. Quite the opposite, where
the naked Spielberg swamp.
Yeah, Spielberg produced that film, and his only note, because he let the director do whatever he wanted, because he trusted him. But his only note was, "I don't get why this scene is in here."
Oh.
And he said, "Listen, I'm not going to pull rank. It's your film. If you think it should be in there, I trust you. But I'm just going to tell you, I don't get why it's there."
I want the reverse to be true. I want there to be in a really serious film, like an Ingmar Bergman, or maybe a Come and See, the Ukrainian war film. There should be a custard pie fight about 50 minutes. When you've had enough drama, and you need a really good... It should be that bromance scene, the basketball court. Yeah. It should happen about 50 minutes in. Some visual gags.
Interesting one is the Naked Gun films. Because they manage to, rather than have that moment at some point where this is suddenly all real, they seem to just sort of walk the tightrope between it's real for Frank Drebin whilst being really weird all the time. Because they work, those movies.
But is that because he's such an established character? Because I think there's two types of jokes, and I was talking to my friend who's trying to write a script called Paul, and he's saying that for the other way around, in a character piece, you're almost setting a character, if you're... You've got the sort of slapstick jokes you can do straight away and do in Naked Gun Hot Shots Pot doing Hot Shots.
I love the Hot Shots movies.
Or you can do the other way where you've got to establish a character, then you've got all the character jokes later. He can only become funny once you get to know him and his sort of foibles. So it's the other way around.
But there are different ways of doing this. I was re-watching... There's a good and a half. There's one and a half good Pink Panther movies, and the one that was made years after they brought it back, the one that isn't in the box set, I think, the one with Christopher Plummer and the jewel heist in it, Return of the Pink Panther. And you watch that one, and that's got quite a good story. It's a good jewel heist story, and then Clouseau's dropped into it, and they alternate the scenes. When Clouseau's on, it's really funny, and he does lots of, and then it cuts to Christopher Plummer, and he's breaking Graham Stark's fingers, and it's a proper like. Treasure of the Sierra Madre sort of adventure in Africa, and they've done that by just swapping between it. And while the funny character, while the comic, it's like Shakespeare, it's like comic relief, but it seems to be impossible to just keep it being funny all the way through.
But that's a really interesting way of doing it, because then you've structurally got the light and fluffy world of the comedy character slowly getting closer and closer to the darkness and what's going to happen when they meet.
Whenever people say we'll do a funny, I mean, I was going to say this with regard to the rom-com with They Came Together, is that the reason they work and the reason Naked Gun works really well is that everyone knows how detective drama works, so it doesn't matter what's going on. You're aware the detective's on a mission and he's going, so it's why Austin Powers works. He's doing a Bond mission, you know how that works. He goes closer and closer to the base. And with the rom-com, I thought that I was slightly delighted and annoyed they'd come out with it, because I've been saying for ages, everyone knows the beats for rom-com.
Yes.
They're as traditional as an Agatha Christie plot. And the fact that no one had pastiched them was almost insulting to the kind of people who love rom-coms, to sort of say, oh, you can only have the real thing, you can't take a joke.
Yeah.
Whereas everyone knows. I've been proposing doing a Richard Curtis take for ages, because you can just set your watch by them in a really nice way, in a comforting way. So they run automatically.
Did they ever bit at the end where, you know, the character suddenly realises what they're
running to the airport.
Chasing after her, and she's in her wedding dress
with
and all of that
uplifting music and stuff like that.
Yeah, oh, it's brilliant. Great. And the thing is, Amy Poehler is fantastic. I mean, if anyone watches Parks and Recreation, they know about Amy Poehler, but she's had sort of limited exposure in films. I mean, Tina Fey is sort of, who's her best friend, I understand, has sort of been a couple of steps ahead of her in terms of that, you know. But the films that Tina Fey's done have largely been duff. I mean, that thing of funny on TV.
Date Night was good.
Date Night is not strong, and it's Tina Fey and Steve Carell, and it's
I enjoyed it as a really really easy watching two good comedy people.
I liked them.
Isn't it frustrating when you see two such funny people doing material that is beneath them, when you know if they'd just given them the money to write it as well, they could have come up with a better film.
I really like a good rom-com. And I like the blandness of it. I like the fact it doesn't threaten. Like Richard Curtis at his best, I really love some of his films, and I really like the blandness of it, and I don't want to be
they're also hard, because I was saying, because obviously if someone, if you've got a partner and you want to occasionally watch a romantic film on Valentine's night, and you've watched Annie Hall and you've watched When Harry Met Sally, and then you've run out, and it's really weird that they appear to be one of those magical things like Raid of the Lost Ark or Star Wars. It must be easy to write another one of those. No, you can't. And you look at Richard Curtis, who is a very good writer, has written lots of good stuff, and he appears to have been able to write two of them.
Four Weddings I think is fantastic, and then I can enjoy Notting Hill, and then they sort of tail off a bit after that for me.
It's kind of weird. You go, this is clearly a very skilled thing, but I thought, what are the other ones I like? I like 500 Days of Summer, the Before Sunrise things, they're quite nice, but they're more romances than romantic comedy.
It's almost an anti-romance 500 Days, though, isn't it?
Well, that's almost the closest I've seen to a parody of a rom-com before.
Yes.
And I really like that.
Of course.
I've missed that one.
I missed that one as well. But yes, I would recommend this.
Is it a date movie then? Or is it laughing at... Say you were on a first date.
Yeah.
Would you... And you... I mean, you really...
You know what?
I
think
David, you really like this girl. Yeah. You're really nervous.
I don't think I would, because it's a bit too cynical, you know? It's a bit cynical because...
So it makes the whole experience...
It would make it look like you didn't believe in love.
Yeah.
Well, it would start off as we're having the best time ever, and then at the hour and a half mark, you'd be just like, oh, something's changed. It doesn't fire you out at the end of this ride. It starts with a loop-the-loop, and then there's just some sort of banking turns for the last 2 minutes of the roller coaster.
You ever want to go and watch a comedy on a first date, though? It's really bad.
A friend of mine took a girl to see Human Centipede on a first date.
That's brilliant.
Why?
He thought it would be sort of interesting.
On a first date?
He didn't really know anything about it either. He thought it would be like... Horror,
a Bug's Life.
A horror, we'll get to hug in the dark or something, but no.
And that was it, surely. So
it never went anywhere, though. You took me to a sewing a girl's mouth to a man's bumhole movie, and that is a niche genre.
Well, you can't ever get married then.
Yeah. No. How did you meet? Human Centipede.
The anecdote's terrible, isn't it? There's a lovely scene in, you know, Freaks and Geeks, the thing that started kind of these bromance movies, because it's Joe Apatow and Paul Feig. There's a lovely scene where they do a long plot arc in Freaks and Geeks where he's in love with the cheerleader who will never be with him, and he finally takes her on a first date, and he takes her to see The Jerk with Steve Martin, and she doesn't understand any of the jokes in it, and it's just a lovely thing of exactly what it would be like as a gawky, whatever, he's 13, 14 year old boy, that he takes her to see the thing that he reckons will be the best film ever, and she goes, why is that man behaving like an idiot? And it killed. And they never mention the romance again. They kill the will they won't they straight away, because if she didn't get The Jerk, she's not
then
worthy of
him. What's the point?
But look, comedies are a hard one for a first date.
Yeah, it's got to be hot. It's got to be mold horror,
mold peril.
Yeah,
mold the Rugrats movie.
Yeah, mold non-sexual peril.
Yeah, you don't want to add in the theme of sexual peril onto a date.
Do you want to go on a date? What are we going to see? How about non-sexual peril?
there's a local flea bit that just does non-sexual peril night.
That's what you want. There's popcorn,
and it's got sofa
and
seats.
And also for seats.
Yeah. So what would be your double bill of non-sexual peril movies?
I'm trying to think what a non-sexual...
Home Alone is a non-sexual peril movie.
It's got to be a bit bland. It's got to be...
Is Romancing the Stone the definitive romantic... that's quite sexy, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a will they, won't they.
But it's not sexual peril. That's the thing. It's not... You know, it's not Hollow Man.
Yeah, The Woodsman.
The Woodsman and Hollow Man. Two predatory Kevin Bacon films in a row.
And then start trying to get off with her when he's... Someone must have done that.
Kevin
must
Bacon's pant it. Loose.
Yeah. Anyway, if you can think of a good non-sexual peril film that might be a good date night thing for people... For the younger people who are out looking to go to the cinema, or perhaps renting, you don't even rent DVDs anymore, do you?
No.
Perhaps download streaming a DVD. I know the sirens as usual.
Yeah. Then you can contact us, let us know. You can email us, dearfilmfandango@gmail.com, or talk to each other on facebook.com/filmfandango, or you can tweet us at filmfandango, at Mr. David Reed, or at Marek Larwood, or at Joel Morris.
Is that me?
On
Twitter? Yeah, I'm Grailfruit on Twitter.
Grailfruit. That's right.
Grailfruit.
So how many Davies did you give when they came together, whatever it was called?
Well, because of my, you know, storytelling lag thing that happens, it's inevitable no matter how good the gags are. I would give this probably a 7, but it is very funny and you will have a good time.
Only 5.5 on IMDb.
That's quite wrong.
This may explain the newspaper's 3-star review that I thought read like a 4-star. Maybe they were feeling your same narrative lag.
Yeah, but oh my God, there's some really good bits. They're really good. But
Robbie, do we all like Paul Rudd as well? Yes. I like Paul Rudd.
I don't know, actually.
I really like Paul
Rudd. He's got this niche of he's always going to get cast as that guy in this film.
But he's good at it. He's the best guy at that. Mm-hmm. You know, Paul Rudd, and he is funny. Like, he is... genuinely funny, and I much prefer him to the Seth Rogans or
I like it when actors do a thing, because there's this myth that actors should be able to do everything, and there's only about 4 actors who do everything, like Alec Guinness and Peter Sellers. Most people are John Lemessurier and they do a thing. And I quite like when they wander in and you go, oh good, Peter Lorre, he'll be doing the Peter Lorre thing.
It's me, really like Peter Lorre.
But maybe they can do other things, but you only get, because casting wise you just literally get cast.
Actors complain about this and you go, but if you're the best guy at this, just Hugh Grant said, you never lose money by being the guy everyone thinks you are.
Yeah.
And it's a nice thing to do.
And if you want to be versatile, do theatre.
Yes, you get asked to do more there.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you want to get bummed.
Oh, Marek, that's not strong.
There we go. I've summed up theatre for you.
Yeah.
I'm really pleased with myself. All right, then. Well, let's... Joel's brought in a film.
Yes, we asked Joel to bring in his favourite film of all time. The film he thought was the best film.
Yeah.
And the film you picked was?
The Wicker Man. But not that one.
Not that
the
one.
The other Wicker Man.
The 2006 remake of The Wicker Man.
The Wicker Man, which people call Nicolas Cage's Wicker Man. But I'd like to cut and say it's not. It is Neil LaBute's Wicker Man, and I'm putting the blame
squarely
at Neil LaBute's
feet.
Why did you pick this?
I just say that, I mean, David's on slightly shaky ground here, having only watched the Carrie remake and the Psycho remake.
I've seen both Wicker Men.
Okay.
I have not seen The Wicker Tree yet.
No one has, not even the director.
But no, The Wicker Man original, obviously, is a near-perfect film and is an absolute classic of horror. And
The original Wicker Man is one of my top three films, without any argument.
Managing to make horror without it being gothic is brilliant.
It's really clever. I was obsessed by it for years. I was in a band and we did an album based on it that was our best-selling album. I visited the locations of The Wicker Man four times and was massively obsessed with The Wicker Man. And when they said they were going to remake it, I went, this will be interesting. So I'm the worst audience for this. But I think I've seen The Wicker Man remake about five times.
Wow.
And oddly, it is strangely compelling. And I'm getting to a point where at some point I may have seen the remake more than the original.
Now,
I fear that.
I watched this, you know, I had an open mind. I enjoy Nicolas Cage films.
Yeah.
I don't enjoy Nicolas Cage films that are trying to be, you know, genuinely good films that often. But I agree, I don't think it's his fault. And what is sort of intriguing, what pulls you into this film is, I think there is genuinely a worthy idea for making a new version of The Wicker Man in there, and it tries so hard to make it work and just doesn't.
It's really odd because there's no point remaking it. The point of The Wicker Man, and what makes The Wicker Man really interesting, is The Wicker Man is in lots of ways, like a lot of great films, not a good film. It is a mess. The guy, Robin Hardy, who directed the original Wicker Man, hadn't directed a film before. He's an ad director. It's done too quickly, low budget. It was cut to pieces, bits of it buried under a motorway. Halfway through, the director said to the cast, oh, we're making a musical. And everyone went, what? And it's a shambles. But it accidentally, through the magic of film, comes together and is one of the most memorable and magical films ever. And what they've done is someone's looked at that, and you read interviews with LaBute, and he went, I've seen this perfect film that all you guys like. I think I can do it better. I think I can fix it.
Yeah.
And he's fixed it in a way you would fix a film in 2006 to get rid of... I mean, the people who made the original Wicker Man, the producers, Delian Spikings and everyone involved at British Lion and who were distributing it, reckoned it was one of the worst films they'd ever seen. And the remake is the film I suspect those producers would have liked to have made in 1973, with all the ugly bumps and lumps smoothed off to make it a proper hero with a proper motive, and none of those embarrassing songs and none of those embarrassing sex scenes, and get rid of all the stuff about him being a virgin. And it shouldn't just be, a policeman. Do policemen really go after missing children? Shouldn't it be his own daughter? All that sort of Liam Neeson-y hero baggage has been added on, and it ruins it.
It does.
By taking all the sharp edges and the bits that don't work, the weird performances and everything out of it, it becomes really boring.
Well, it sanitises the isolation of it, that, oh, so he's looking for his own daughter and his ex is on the island, so he's not alone.
He's got a friend. The original Wicker Man is a song about... It's a film about... clash of ideologies. So I reckon you could make a modern version of it and it would have some relevance. It's about one belief system hitting another belief system, and the person you're following him being a bit of a prig, but he's the hero, he's the policeman, and you slowly learn that he might be wrong and you mistrust the authority figure. All this stuff's really rich and clever in the original, and instead of that they have this guy who goes to an island, and because he's not a virgin in this version, it's not a sex thing and not a fertility cult, and they sort of fudge that, and then they haven't thought it through.
It's a honey cult.
It's every good idea in the original is made a weak idea in this one to make
him
more
heroic. Can
you tell
us what, roughly, for people who haven't seen what the basic film is about?
The basic film is, he is a copper he's a motorcycle cop in this one who's allergic to bees, and he goes to, but he gets a letter. He witnesses a mysterious road accident where a girl and her mother disappear from a car, and then he gets a letter saying, come to Summer's Isle. They've added an S in to Summer Isle to make it a different film. So it's Summer's Isle in this film, and the teacher fluffs it and says Summer Isle once, which is really funny. But she says, go to Summer's Isle, a girl has gone missing, and there's an implication it might be his daughter with an estranged partner he hasn't seen for ages. So he gets a call to adventure, and he flies off to this remote community where it's run by Ellen Burstyn in the Christopher Lee role as the leader of a cult who appear to be sort of slightly pagan, slightly old-fashioned, and it's women only, and the men are entirely mute on the island, and he doesn't understand what's going on, so he wanders around for an hour and a half going, what's going on, at people louder and louder and louder. And at the end, the same twist as in the original, it turns out that they are, that the girl isn't really missing, and they're chasing
him. It's been the plan all along. It's been a trap
to tempt him through. And the odd thing about doing a twist film now is that everyone's sort
why
of
do you remake twist. A twist film and keep the twist the same? I mean, that makes no
it's
sense.
It's the only respectable thing in it is they do, he doesn't get rescued by helicopters at the end. But there's this, it's really odd because they've repurposed all the stuff about Clash of Belief and him being a Christian copper and all the drama about one fundamentalist bumping into another fundamentalist, yes, which is still relevant. They've changed that into Neil LaBute's usual thing of, if women ruled the world, it would be just as screwed up, eh, guys? And it's just like The Worm That Turned by the two Ronnies. It's just really misogynist. And he just spends his whole time punching women.
That idea, he punches so many women in this. As if the writers have gone, if this was in a normal film, he'd punch the bad guy at this point. Can we not still do that?
Neil LaBute wrote it, and you get the feeling that at that point he's going, that's it. It's so transparent why he's taken this film and what the things he's changed about it. Some of the things he's changed about it are to make it more of a Hollywood film. So he saved all the sort of Robert McKee, Save the Cat, formulaic, heroic writing that he saves a little girl's doll at the beginning in a kind of put the bunny back in the box, Con Air kind of way. And it's his daughter who's gone missing, and he's heroic, and you see all that sort of stuff. And all that stuff that they've added in and changed is in the service of partly making it a more acceptable film to a mainstream audience, which is a terrible thing to do to a cult film, because that's not the point of it. But also because Neil LaBute wants to talk about women.
Yeah.
And so...
But I think there's a kernel of that being interesting. The idea of a rather brash American, you know, cop representative of the patriarchy coming into clash with a matriarchy who they just have no respect for him at all. That is in itself potentially interesting. Yeah. And it isn't in this film.
Well, I think that's a film that would be written by Alison Anders or someone. Basically, it would require a woman to write that for it to have any effect, which is the whole point with Anthony Schaffer's Wicker Man. He's interested in pagan culture, and he puts a priggish, upright Christian in it and questions his Christian faith.
Yes.
Whereas Neil LaBute is never going to question Nicolas Cage's masculinity. So the idea of this film doesn't work anyway. He goes, makes this journey to meet all these matriarchs. And I rewatched the ending of the original Wicker Man after this to cleanse my palate. And there's a brilliant bit in when Edward Woodward's in the Wicker Man and he's blazing away. And he does this sermon. He preaches a sermon in the Wicker Man. It's incredibly powerful. And I've not noticed it, even though I've seen the Wicker Man dozens of times, that he finishes his sermon and all the crowded round the villagers who are crowded around don't react. And all you hear is the quacking of ducks that are in the sacrifice with him.
Yes.
And it's as if no one's listening. That the enormous certainty of the Bible is falling on deaf ears, and it's incredibly powerful. And that would be possible in this film, that his certainty about his masculinity and his gun and his punching would fall on deaf ears, but that's not, they haven't bothered to do that.
Well, the makers seem unaware that that is a conflict within their own script. They don't seem to see, you know,
but it's the only story that's in there. But it's anyway, apart from that, it's very, very funny, and it's they do stupid things like that. It's all about human sacrifice. Someone must die that the crops do not fail. Next year is the plot in both films. And in this one, halfway through, because they're feeling it's lagging a bit, they kill someone.
Yes.
They kill the harbour master halfway through.
No reason.
And you go, was he not a reasonable sacrifice? The whole point about the first one was the sanctity of a single life.
Yeah.
And the second one, they go, should be more murders. It's a horror film. So
something's eaten his hand.
Yeah, it's just terrible.
It's not unenjoyable. And Nicholas, it's odd. Have you seen Vampire's Kiss?
No.
Oh, we've talked about it before. But
Nicholas Cage has cropped up quite a lot in as one of the sort of quite idiosyncratic film stars of our time, but his performances, having seen quite a lot of them, are so odd, especially in Vampire's Kiss.
Yeah.
If he'd have performed this film with a sort of odd, you see glimpses of it when he's sort of swatting away these imaginary bees.
Yeah.
Obviously, put the bees on in post CGI.
Yeah.
So you can see him sort of swatting and doing some. But his acting is quite straight in this, and it's on the brink, and it's got cult status for being a comedy now. If you go into watching it as a comedy,
from the bees, my eyes.
Well, see, everyone, what I find fascinating about this is that everyone, it is a camp version of the film, and Cage has gone on record saying we knew it was funny, and again, that's the standard excuse. That's the Tommy Wiseau, the room excuse. I don't think you did, and it's a serious. The original one's takes itself seriously. It's a serious film, and there is a serious film you can make about this. But what's odd is that Cage's performance is slightly over the top. And it's a bad performance in a film where you're meant to be the sane man amongst mad people to do a madman in there. But it doesn't work. And he's got these strange... His teeth are weird. He's got Dick Emery's vicar's teeth. It's the closest he gets to being Christian Copper, is he looks like a Dick Emery vicar. And his missus has got a weird bee-stung mouth through to plastic surgery. So they're the weird mouth people. She's really distracting. And it doesn't... You almost want... his performance is so odd in it that people are liking it for being camp. I think the real achievement of this as a film to watch is, A, it makes you appreciate how good the original is. Because occasionally they dip back into the Anthony Schaffer screenplay for a minute. And the film just catches fire every time they just do the meeting on the harbour side and That's Not Me's daughter, though. It's brilliant. Every time they burn, the actual burning happens, it catches fire. It's an amazing film. And every time they deviate, you realise what a better writer Schaffer is than Neil LaBute. But I think as a writer, I find it fascinating because they've made every single mistake you could make in fixing this film. And as a writer, you're constantly asked to fix the rough bits in your script. And I think this film is a proof of, when you've got a cult classic like With Nell and I, if you came in and said, can there be some girls in it, you ruin With Nell and I. Yeah. All the good decisions you could make, all the sensible decisions you can make about fixing what's wrong with a film have been made. And it's terrible. And they should have left it well alone. And it's quite, I find it fascinating for that.
Another thing I thought was interesting was that the look of it is so... They've gone for a sort of glossy, almost a Tony Scott film look.
It's yellow. It's the yellowest film. It's honey so yellow.
Weird. It's not a horror movie look. No. And the choice of camera angles and everything is like it's a procedural cop thing rather than it's a psychological thriller.
Well, I think with the original, what's great about the original is you don't know what you're watching. I've sat and watched the original when it wasn't widely known. I've seen sort of 16mm prints of it where people laughed because it looks camp, like a 70s sex comedy, and occasionally. So the original looks like a Hammer film, and then they keep putting the rug out under you and it's weirder and weirder and weirder. So the idea of making it sort of a genre mashup is quite faithful to the original. It should be a police procedural where it's like Alien starts looking like a space film and it turns into a haunted house film.
Yes.
You're a psycho. You can do a genre mashup to keep people on the back foot. But this one's just rubbish. And it also, one of the biggest achievements of it is it's set on an island that's only got women on it and mute men.
Yes.
And it fails the Bechdel test. Two women never speak to each other.
Is that right?
I was watching it going, they never talk to each other. It's amazing. It's basically a film full of women who never actually discuss anything.
Yeah.
It's just Nicolas Cage shouting and punching women.
Punching women.
It could be this astonishing sort of feminist or question.
And also, they seem
film.
To sort of take tentative steps down the path of, he's losing his mind, how much of this is real?
Yeah.
But then that never pays
that's,
off in
that's
anything.
Always done through the... It's literally, what can we do? It's the shaking pills thing.
Yeah.
Everyone,
he's got shaky pills, isn't he?
Yeah, that's what he has pills. He's that bit. Just hold a bottle, shake the pills, and everyone thinks that you might be
missing. He does a double dream as well, which is always, in a horror film, it's reaching for desperation. Doing the wake up from a dream thing is always cheap, but he does it and then wakes up again.
I'm still in the dream.
Like no one ever does.
Yes.
And it's brilliant.
But I found it really interesting to watch as... You think, filmmaking's actually quite a hard art form.
Yes.
You watch this because it almost has all the mistakes, all the cuts are wrong, the acting's wrong. There's so many mistakes, it's interesting to watch.
It crosses the lines a few times. Badly directed, as in you can't understand what's going on in some shots. But I think, having made a film and things, it is really hard to make a film. And I think what I like about this is that you've taken these elements. It's a good story, the original. You can't really, even this can't break it. The idea of the man going to the island where no one is trustworthy and things. But they've broken everything. I mean, the central... If you said, what's The Wicker Man about? It's about a man who gets a letter to go to an island because a girl's gone missing. And they've added in a mysterious extra missing girl at the beginning who you're distracted by and they never tell you what it is. So you forget he's on a missing girl hunt because it's more about how did he see this sort of slightly don't-look-now girl in a red dress thing they borrowed from Nicholas Rogue. So you forget the actual story because they've put another story around it. And then when he gets there, he's amongst strangers, but he knows one of them.
Mm.
So every time he goes to go and see his ex-girlfriend, she explains the island to him. But as a scriptwriter, you're watching it going, she explains the island a bit and then stops explaining it for reasons that make no sense.
And doesn't question it. Yeah, like, his police work is appalling. Like, he goes, tell me what's happened. And she says something a bit Phoebe from Frenzy. And then he goes, All right, well, I'll go over here then.
Yeah, so his investigation could be solved by just taking her to a coffee shop and saying, tell me everything about the island you grew up on and live on.
Yeah.
So the idea of him being a man alone amongst strangers has been removed. So you go, well, what have you got left? And the answer is punching women and bees.
Yeah.
Allergic to bees.
And him in a bear costume is great. Oh. Nicolas Cage wandering around in a bear costume.
He looks so hot. He's sweaty throughout. When he puts on the bear costume, he looks really uncomfortable. And
I notice his hair is quite bad. It's a bad hair film for Nicolas Cage. And also, his ears, they're prosthetic ears made from wax.
With the teeth and the ears, it looks like he's like playing a character from Lord of the Rings, like he's from a different species. So again, it doesn't work. The whole point with Edward Woodward in the original is Woodward is A, a terrific actor, and B, a very good everyman.
Mm.
A quite good a pillar of the community. Well, one of the mistakes they make on... being a nerd about the original, one of the mistakes they make in the original one when they did a director's cut of it, which is the one everyone watches now, is it opens on the mainland and you find out that no one trusts Edward Woodward's character, that he's a bit of a sort of a religious bigot. Whereas in the original film, he just, as it was originally cut, he just flies onto the island and you go, oh, policeman, it's Callan, I trust him. And the point with Nicolas Cage is he looked weird from the beginning, so you kind of go, well, there's something up with him, he's all twitchy.
Well, they make him look like the T-1000 at the beginning, with his sort of robotic movements.
And he's a motorcycle cop.
And he's a dick to the people he stops for speeding and stuff.
They don't say the cat, he's a horrible man.
In the script, it's like, the first line he says is it's the equivalent of, can I see your licence of registration, please? It's one of those. But he just goes, give me a licence of registration. And then, just like, what? And is he
little,
doing?
And the little girl in the back of the car is worse than Veruca Salt, one of the most spoiled, awful kids. And she gets killed and you go, well, I'm glad she's dead. And it's just, as far as audience sympathies go, it's a high-functioning, weird film that doesn't appear to understand humans. And I like those kind of films.
And also, the most famous bit of it is utterly unnecessary. The bees in my eye, because they're going to kill him in a different way, so they've really crowbarred this in.
One of the things that also works on the original is that he's not under threat throughout.
Yes.
Whereas in this one, because it's a bad modern horror film, they're constantly sort of trapping him in basements that are filling with water.
For no reason.
And he went, if this is a sacrifice, you could have done it then.
Yeah.
And people who are in on the plot keep saving him from dying so that he can die at the end as part of a ritual they don't explain.
Yes.
And so what would you watch this film? Why would you recommend this film to?
I like it because it's funny. I don't know anyone who hasn't enjoyed watching this because it's a good film to talk over because it's funny. But when we were away shooting my horror film last year, after a really bad day's filming, we all went back at 2 a.m. and watched this. No one had seen it but from me. And the next morning we felt amazing. If you're making a film, you should watch this film because it will make you feel like your film's going to be brilliant.
There's a recommendation.
Sorry, I was going to ask if The Wicker Man's in your top three. What are the other two?
Oh, that's really hard because you should always say that because you should never name the other two because then you can shoot. I don't know. Probably if it was Horror, The Innocents and Dark Water, and if it's other things, probably Raiders and Charade.
Dark Water. I've seen the remake of that.
Oh, the original Dark Water's amazing.
So I've not seen The Innocents either.
Innocence is genuinely a perfect film. It's the Turn of the Screw, ghost story, Henry James ghost story, filmed by Jack Clayton, who made almost nothing else, but cinematography's by Freddie Francis, who did The Elephant Man. It's just it's a 1960. Peter Wingard plays a ghost in it. It was the other thing I was going to bring in, but it's a serious film, so it's not as funny.
He made us watch that
rubbish
shit.
Film. You could have watched The Innocents. Do watch The Innocents because it's the best. I think the best ghost story ever committed to film.
Oh, okay. Cool. Okay. Well, that's us for this week. Thank you for coming in. Do you have anything you want to plug at all?
Listen to Kevin Eldon. We'll see you now on Radio 4 at 11 o'clock on Tuesdays.
Correct.
Really good.
Do that. I concur. All right. We'll be back next week with yet more films.
Keep
watching the films. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.